Jay Powell gave a speech today. What he meant and what Wall Street heard. Oh, and here's a hint. It had to do, of course, with the trade wars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 4th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Marketplace number of the day this Tuesday is 5. 5 members of the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. That's the one that gets to decide interest rates, remember. 5 of them gave public speeches today, and believe me when I tell you, for the Fed, that is a whole lot of talking. Central bankers have not, at least historically, been the most say-what's-on-your-mind group of people. That has been changing, though, as we've been reporting. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us today, it has potential upsides and downsides.
Back in 1996, then-Fed Chair Alan Greenspan uttered the words irrational exuberance in a speech. Investors thought he was saying stocks were overvalued and the market tanked. Probably not what Greenspan intended, but he did want to be opaque, says economist Frederick Mishkin, who served as a Fed governor in the mid-2000s. Mishkin says one time after testifying to Congress,
one of the Congress people said, that was very clear, and Alan Greenspan said, well, then it must have been a mistake.
But under the next Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, transparency and frequent communication became guiding principles. That's continued under his successors.
If you can get the markets to understand how you will react to future events, that can actually make things, monetary policy, more effective.
A lot of what current Chairman Jerome Powell communicates, says University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson, is to reassure us that the Fed's got its eye on the ball and on the news.
Oh, and they're aware that obviously the trade issues have the potential to have a big impact, so they're watching them really closely.
Chairman Powell does have to contend with one communications challenge his predecessors didn't, says Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And that's a president who publicly criticizes the Fed.
Powell is going to bend over backwards to say, we're not going to listen to the president telling us to lower rates.
But Baker says if economic conditions warrant it, Powell won't hesitate to cut rates and explain exactly why. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let me pause here for a second to point out Mitchell's last couple of lines there. Chair Powell was one of the speech givers today, and here is his operative quote, should you have been wondering when I was going to point out the way, way up day on Wall Street. Talking about the president's trade war, Mr. Powell said, we don't know how or when these issues will be resolved. As always, we will act as appropriate to sustain the expansion. Wall Street heard that as, hey, the Fed is going to cut interest rates if things keep going this way. Speaking of which, trade wars, that is, we've got China, Mexico, quite possibly, and now maybe India. Right at the end of last week, President Trump announced he was taking India off a list of countries that get special trade status, beneficiary developing country. It's called. That happens tomorrow. It's a done deal. So we have called Sarah McGregor. She's a trade editor for Bloomberg News to help explain. Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Let's do a little definition of terms first here, shall we? Beneficiary developing country. What does that mean?
So that's a program that exists for industrialized nations, for rich nations, to help their poor nations sort of get up to speed to be able to build their markets and have some of the same production quality that would make their goods desirable to sell overseas.
And they get benefits tariff-wise because of that, right?
Yes. The generalized system of preferences,
right.
It's something that's existed since the 70s. It's just a way for industrialized nations to allow less developed countries to come up to speed, to become more competitive with their exports.
Okay, so this now goes away, the president says, effective tomorrow. What is India going to lose when it doesn't have access to this generalized system of preferences?
This is a move that the Trump administration is taking to sort of exert maximum economic leverage over a country using the threat of tariffs. In this case, it's taking away duty-free access to about 2,000 Indian products, Indian exports, things like farming goods and pharmaceuticals and autos and even small companies that might produce, let's say, jewelry. So it's taking away this duty-free access they've enjoyed for decades because India didn't play ball with them. They didn't, in the last 60 days, come up with a way to help the U.S. reduce its trade deficit with India.
Which is, as we know, the president's favorite measure of economic progress, I suppose. So what are American consumers going to notice when this happens tomorrow?
This removal of the duty-free access will affect about $6 billion worth of Indian exports to the U.S. And, you know, if you compare it with, let's say, what's happening with China or Trump's threat to impose duties on every single Mexican import that comes into the U.S., this is small potatoes. But I think what it actually does is just really drive home the point that the Trump administration is willing to go to any length in its fight to try and, what it says, level the playing field with countries, including allies. Okay. India is a political ally and a defense ally, security ally with the U.S. It was hit with these steel and aluminum tariffs that the Trump administration imposed last year. It's not been exempted from that. And, you know, these are small countries. They don't have the same ability as, well, smaller countries to exert pressure on the Trump administration.
This comes at an interesting time in the Indian economy, right? I mean, there was just an election. Prime Minister Modi was reelected, and it is the fastest growing sort of major-ish economy in the world. But there's huge unemployment. There's a skills gap. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on over there.
Absolutely. So in removing this duty-free access, the Trump administration's essentially saying India is not a developing economy anymore. You know, it doesn't deserve this special status. You know, that's very much up for question, given the big inequality in India, the poverty, the fact that the prime minister there, you know, is really trying to boost its own manufacturing sector to try and shore up, much the same way Trump wants to do in America with his Make America Great Again sort of policies. So it really is a whammy to the efforts of the government there to try and shore up growth and bring in people from the sidelines right now. You know, there's obviously massive poverty and a lot of unemployment in India.
You alluded to it earlier, but I do want to remind people. So this would be, let's see, we've got China, we've got Mexico, we've got threats of auto tariffs on the European Union and Japan. This would now be the fourth front in the president's trade war?
And on top of that, he said today, you know, he's in London meeting Theresa May, that he wants to try and get a deal with the UK over trade as well. And so there's a lot of moving parts.
Sarah McGregor, she's a trade editor at Bloomberg. Sarah, thanks a bunch. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, oh, it was up, way up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The public comment period on a proposal from the Trump administration, one that could affect more than 40 million Americans who get SNAP benefits, what used to be called food stamps, that comment period closes today. The proposal would loosen the definition of staple foods, so more retailers could participate in SNAP. Think convenience stores, gas stations, even liquor stores as well. The challenge is what exactly the definition of staple foods winds up being. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that one.
The proposal would tweak a 2014 Obama-era rule requiring that stores that accept SNAP benefits offer more food options for low-income families, a range of healthier foods. But Ava Rigamonti with the National Association of Convenience Stores says it's hard for mom-and-pop stores, especially in rural areas, to live up to those standards.
They can't afford to participate in the program and take up, you know, important shelf and cooler space for items that aren't going to sell, that are too difficult to get.
When local retailers can't meet the standards to participate in SNAP, Rigamonti says the program's beneficiaries are the ones who suffer.
When you don't have these stores participating in the program, you are limiting SNAP beneficiaries' access to food.
Right now, 119,000 convenience stores nationwide participate in SNAP. Rigamonti says that number could increase under the new proposal, but it would come at a cost, according to Margot Wooten, vice president for nutrition at the Center for Science and the Public Interest.
Lower income families that rely on convenience and dollar stores can't make a meal out of Slim Jim's spray cheese and pimento stuffed olives.
She says the change would give retailers who are already in the program an incentive to stock less healthy food.
Makes it less likely that a small store will actually offer fruits, vegetables, whole grain bread, and, you know, truly staple foods that people need.
The public comment period for the proposal ends tonight at 11:59 Eastern. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
We mentioned yesterday the four-letter word currently bedeviling the tech industry, regulation. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are taking renewed interest in what Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple are doing. Congress says it's interested, too. Thing is, technology's biggest conglomerates routinely spend a lot of time and money trying to persuade lawmakers in Washington. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, big tech might be facing some costs of a different kind now.
Federal regulators have been monitoring and sometimes restricting the tech industry for years. But now, with Congress involved and presidential candidates getting applause for promising to break up companies, things seem to be picking up speed. But until tech companies know what direction they're headed...
What matters is the amount of resources, effort, and time they have to spend thinking about these issues and how those resources could have been used to think about strategy in a different way.
Ben Schachter is a senior analyst following tech companies at the Macquarie Group. He means issues like breaking up companies, more stringent privacy policies, improving competitiveness. Microsoft famously fell behind in terms of innovation while fighting government lawyers in the 1990s. And Schachter says tougher tech regulations elsewhere, like in Europe, have already revealed how a crackdown can impact business.
I would think that there would have been a lot more mergers and acquisitions in this space if it wasn't for the fact that they are still looked at from regulators around the world.
And American regulators are ready to join that group, which, says Avery Gardiner at the Center for Democracy and Technology, can be good for the broader tech industry. As for the giants...
The fact that it costs them some time and money and lawyer fees... is an acceptable cost to bear to make sure that we have a competitive, well-functioning economy.
With enough room for other companies to grow. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
For all the headlines and economic indicators that say the economy is doing all right, at the least, there is a huge slice of this population that just isn't seeing that. And it hasn't been seeing any signs of a growing economy for a decade or more. Chris Ornati is a writer and photographer who's got a new book out about that group of Americans. It's called Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First thing I need you to do for me, I guess, is define back row America. That's kind of the thread that goes through this book.
It's the segment of America that doesn't have what I call an elite education, people who have finished high school. And if they have an education beyond that, it's primarily through community college or trade schools or state schools, smaller state schools. And they tend to generally... correlated with that is they tend to stay in the community mm-hmm. close by to where they were born. Their lives are in kind of stark contrast to what I call the front row, which is myself, basically. Yeah. I'm a member of the front row who has a PhD has moved a lot. And I guess some people would call that the elites.
You alluded to it. I need to follow up because it goes to my next question. You are a physics PhD, right?
Correct.
You were a bond trader on Wall Street for something like 20 years.
Correct.
So tell me how you came to write this book, which was experiential. You went out and drove around this country for like 3, 4, 5 years.
Right. I would say a large part of what happened was the financial crisis made me rethink what I was doing as a banker and kind of making choices that had impacted other people's lives. And not really knowing what that impact was. I had always taken these long walks across New York, and I ended up going to parts of New York that I was told not to go to. Communities have been long stigmatized for having crime or poverty or drugs. I ended up spending so much time doing that I ended up quitting my job in 2012 and spending 2 to 3 years in those communities in New York City. What I saw there so frustrated me that I felt kind of like I wanted to see if it was true across the rest of the country. So I got in my van and drove for 3 years.
And it is true, which is the narrative of this book. Chapter one of Dignity is McDonald's. You spent a lot of time in McDonald's across this country. How come?
Right. For the people at the most marginal parts of society, the homeless addicts, they spend a lot of time in McDonald's to gain a moment of dignity, kind of just be kind of invisible where people don't stare at them as kind of not being allowed to be there. This role McDonald's played in many communities that were otherwise devastated was as kind of almost a community center. It was kind of being used by retirees, other people who, you know, blue-collar jobs, who would come in there every morning and get together with others and have group meetings. Or I even saw people playing, you know, bingo games there.
Yeah, that was a crazy picture. They've got like the whole bingo basket, and there's people around, you know, sitting in McDonald's having a bingo game.
And church groups, people playing chess, people playing checkers, dominoes, the whole thing.
There's a question of value in this book, and you stated explicitly sort of later on, maybe even in the conclusion, about what we value in this economy and in this society. And you admit that you, for a long time, put a lot of value on the credentialed life, right? The elite school degree, the high-powered job. And in fact, what a huge chunk of this country values are other things like place and family.
Right. I call those kind of the non-credential forms of meaning or non-economic forms of meaning. You know, when those things are erased or degraded, we don't really see them as great a loss as they are because we can't put a number to it. One of the negatives of the way we've moved the world in the last 30 years is the loss of community. When a factory leaves, it devastates a community. It doesn't just lose jobs. It loses so many forms of meaning that these communities are just completely devastated.
It is a profound book, honestly, well worth anybody's time. It's called Dignity, Seeking Respect in Backrow America by Chris Arnotti. Chris, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
You can see some of the pictures Chris made during his travels. We've got them at marketplace.org. Coming up.
It makes people worse at decision making, I think you would say.
Why sometimes our decisions are only as good as the air that we breathe. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Big rally for the Dow today, up 512 points, 2%, 25,332 for the blue chips. The tech-heavy NASDAQ rebounded after yesterday's slide, rising 194 points, 2.6%, 75.27. The S&P 500 advanced 58 points, 2.1%, 28.03 there. Auto stocks were up today. Amid reports, some Republican lawmakers are discussing whether to block or try to block President Trump's planned new tariffs on Mexican goods. Automakers, that is, as we have reported, would be hit hard by those tariffs. GM revved up 6%. Ford boosted 3.2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace. You know, Marketplace is a source you trust for information about the economy and how it affects our lives. We're also a nonprofit news organization, and we are counting on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Any donation helps, but if you give $30 right now, it'll be matched dollar for dollar by another one of our generous supporters, the Candida Fund. Please become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As I said yesterday on the program, we have gotten the data back from our most recent Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll. One of the things we focused on for this version was the 9-to-5 portion of our economic lives, work and how we go about it. We asked people, among other things, whether they would rather work 8 hours, 5 days a week, or 10 hours, 4 days a week. Almost two-thirds of people went with longer days, shorter work weeks. So we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to find out more about the value of a flexible schedule for the modern worker.
In some professions, fewer, longer days are already the norm. Shelley Rudolph is an emergency room nurse. Her husband is a SWAT officer, and they both work long days. She typically does 3 shifts a week, 12 or 13 hours each. The couple coordinates their schedules, so one of them is always with their 4 kids.
So I can get my children's projects finished. I can be present in their school, I can volunteer, I can take them on vacations.
Plus, they don't need to pay for childcare. The downsides, she often works holidays, doesn't have much time with her husband, and the long days can be crazy.
I deal with anything from heart attacks to strokes to septic shock. You don't eat, you don't drink, you know, you don't go to the bathroom during a 12, 13-hour shift.
But she says she wouldn't have it any other way because of the time she gets with her kids. And when you think about it,
there's nothing natural about the 5-day work week.
Dean Baker is an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says longer work weeks were the norm until 1938, when Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act. That law established a minimum wage and overtime for workers who logged more than 40 hours per week.
So it was a big struggle to get there, and then we largely froze here. But in other countries, we've continued to see declines in a standard work week. So in France, it's now 35 hours. And, you know, it's shorter in Germany.
63% of workers in our poll said they'd prefer a four-day work week. That skewed slightly higher for men and workers older than 35. But Baker says moving away from the five-day, 40-hour week will be hard. It's just so ingrained at this point.
It's almost like I'm speaking gibberish when I say, you know, we could shorten the work week.
In the past, Damian Dawson has worked 50, 60, 70 hours a week. But right now, he typically works 30, and he does it in 3 or 4 days.
This job right here is by far the best because I get to make my own schedule and I control my own pace.
He's a hospice chaplain, which means most of his time is spent visiting patients at the end of their lives or filling out paperwork.
I'm going to do that sometime this weekend, probably from a cigar lounge. They got free Wi-Fi.
Maybe he'll stay for a poker game after. A bit of self-care for a job that still takes an emotional toll, even with the flexible schedule. Damian can actually put a number to how much he values that flexibility.
Between myself and what some of the people work at the hospital where I used to work, it's probably about a $5,000 difference in yearly compensation.
Plus, his old benefits were better and cheaper. But is it worth it? He says, definitely. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Here's another workplace issue, getting more money for what you do. If you have tried to negotiate for more pay successfully or not, we want to hear about it. Let us know at marketplace.org. You look around the modern office building, you got your computers, some stand-up desks, cubicles, still, I'd bet, in a lot of places. What you probably don't have, windows that open. Most offices today are pretty airtight, so some of what we breathe out, carbon dioxide, stays in. Veronique Greenwood wrote about this in the New York Times recently in a piece headlined, "Is Conference Room Air Making You Dumber?" Veronique, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So there we are, sitting in a smallish conference room, breathing as people do. And it turns out, based on the research that you've written about, maybe that's not the best thing for creativity and productivity in the workplace.
Right, exactly. Actually, when I first heard about this research, I thought, well, that sounds a little paranoid.
Yeah.
And the more I looked, the more it became clear that there's a small but pretty interesting body of evidence accrued over the last 10 years or so, suggesting that carbon dioxide, which has generally been thought to be harmless, may have some effects on cognitive function when it builds up to levels that are actually pretty common in places like conference rooms and in classrooms and offices in general.
What does it do to our brains? Are we just less creative and less clear thinking?
The thing about the CO2 is that it's not an absolutely consistent effect, but in the studies that have found an effect, it makes people worse at decision-making, I think you would say.
Wow.
The test that they use, it has headings like capacity to pay attention, capacity to gather information from different sources.
Right.
And these two really well-designed studies found that scores on these tests went down with higher carbon dioxide.
Yeah. So what are we supposed to do other than like throw a chair through the window? Because it's not like we can change this.
No, well, actually, someone can. There are people whose job it is to keep the fans going and keep the air moving. And chances are there's somebody in your office building who can answer questions about this. You just might not know them yet.
Yeah. This is a really basic question, but it's us breathing that gets the carbon dioxide in the room, right?
Right.
which, of course, is a whole nother layer of problem because you got to breathe.
Exactly. That's not going to stop.
Right.
But what needs to potentially change, if the effects continue to happen, if they keep seeing them in studies, then really the best way to deal with this is to up the ventilation. And actually, one of the researchers I talked to, Joe Allen at Harvard, has said that even though it costs more money for office buildings to keep the air moving, it's possible that you could actually recoup the losses from increased productivity because there's quite a lot of evidence now that, for instance, children in school classrooms do much better on tests. They complete more work. They're absent less when there's a lot of ventilation, and the same could probably be true for people in offices.
Do you think about this when you get stuck in a meeting?
I mean, of course I do.
That's right. That's the right answer. Vernet Greenwood, she's a science writer writing in the New York Times recently about conference rooms and the air we breathe. Vernique, thanks very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, the brief detente between Cuba and the United States that happened late in the Obama administration got a bit colder today. The White House has banned the most common way that Americans go to Cuba, the group educational and cultural trips, usually called people-to-people exchanges. Also banned, cruise ships, private yachts, and fishing boats. The caveat emptor here is this. If you've got tickets for Cuba dated after today, air or sea, check with your carrier. All right, we're done. The Dow Industrial is up 512 today, 2%. Thank you, Jay Powell. The NASDAQ up 194 points, 2.6%. The S&P 500 advanced 58 points, 0.2%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.